Welcome back, folks. We are trying to hook up with Colonel Jeff McCausland, CBS military analyst, to get the latest on the Israel-Iran conflict. What we know right now is Iran has basically said to the international community that they will not allow the IAEA auditors in order to determine and assess the damages that were made to the production facilities inside the territorial boundaries of the country of Iran. They will not cooperate. Well, that's not a good start, right? We do know that the Houthis have started to fire on ships, international shipping, through the Strait of Hormuz and other straits there. I don't know whether or not there's been any retaliation by the U.S. There has been by Israel. Further, we know that there's been additional actions being taken by Hezbollah. All right, we've got Colonel Jeff McCausland, CBS military analyst. Colonel, welcome to the show.
Newell, always a pleasure.
Colonel, a lot has happened between the last time you and I talked and now. I don't know how much consequence all of these actions are, but I think, and you tell me what you're hearing, but folks I'm talking to are having a real difficult time trying to figure out what state of this ceasefire, where we're going, where's the strategy, how this is playing out at the present time. Your thoughts?
Well, obviously you're talking about the potential ceasefire in the Gaza Strip, and apparently there are at least indirect negotiations going on in Qatar between the Israelis and Hamas. Now, how quickly those will come to fruition remains to be seen. The general outline of the agreement seems to be a 60-day ceasefire. During that particular ceasefire, 10 living Israeli hostages would be released. I think up to 18 remains of hostages would also be released. Not all at one time. It stretched out throughout that period. During that 60-day ceasefire, there would be negotiations on an end to the conflict, which I think is the major sticking point. Hamas has been insisting on a full withdrawal of Israeli forces from the Gaza Strip, and Israel, of course, is insisting on really the total elimination of Hamas, either by them surrendering, handing over their weapons and a lot of their leadership, departing the Gaza Strip entirely, and something along those lines. And so that is the general outline of what's being discussed right now on both sides. The president said that he could envision an agreement coming together. I think he said this week or perhaps next week. But obviously when you get these kind of negotiations, Newell, you know, it's like football. The last two or three yards are the toughest part of the process.
Colonel, what is the likelihood of reaching an agreement that says that Hamas is banned from Gaza?
To me, that's very difficult to envision Hamas accepting that, though they are so eviscerated that they may well be willing to do so. And there's some reports of even growing opposition to Hamas in the Gaza Strip. I mean, you're basically, you know, if you will, not just surrendering. You're basically saying, I will accept extinction as an outcome for these particular negotiations. And that being said as well, then the next question, even if you get to that point, Neil, you got to talk about, and then what? What do you do with the Gaza Strip? The Israelis, I think, are inclined to occupy the Gaza Strip if they're going to do that. We found during our occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan that it took about 20 soldiers per 1,000 to control a population. Well, it doesn't take a math major to figure out if you're talking about a population of over 2 million, which is the Gaza Strip. Then you're talking about 40,000 Israeli soldiers doing nothing but occupation duty. And, oh, by the way, you have forces that have got to control now portions of Lebanon that you've occupied, portions of Syria. You've got a serious presence on the West Bank because there's 3 million or more Palestinians on the West Bank. And you're also involved in some degree an air campaign with the Houthis down in Yemen who are periodically, and I think in the last few days, have launched a missile on Ben-Gurion Airport, and the potential of having to strike Iran again. So that's an awful lot of military requirements being stacked up for the Israeli Defense Forces. And then finally, as you try to think what happens after that agreement, there's the humanitarian problem, and that is that 2 million Palestinians, about a quarter to half of which right now we think are in serious food shortage condition, and how you provide, you know, basic foods, medical supplies, clean water, et cetera, to that population as you move towards some kind of a recovery.
Is it something that we could rebuild, re-engineer, redesign in Gaza and still have the Palestinians there in the short, medium, and long term?
I think that's feasible. Others, I think, probably would disagree. But getting from where we are now to a rebuilt stage, what does that population do and how are they sustained in the interim? It remains a question. One might recall that several months ago, Mr. Trump talked about building, you know, sort of Riviera on the Mediterranean, on the Gaza Strip, but at the same time suggested this might require the departure of the population. Again, 2 million people, where are they going to go? Well, most people would say, well, they could go to Jordan or they could go to Egypt. Neither of those two countries, frankly, are terribly excited about accepting that level of refugees. Both of those countries have suffered economically, Egyptians in particular, as from repercussions from this conflict, and whether they could sustain that level of additional refugees and also be concerned about the fact that a certain percentage may be elements of Hamas, which might threaten their stability as well, I think is a real open question.
So what would be the next move? I mean, it just seems just so volatile still, right? I mean, you start bringing in aid, hard to identify who Hamas is, who isn't. You have additional skirmishes, additional gunfire, emotions all over the place. And you get into the circular thing that you may not ever get out of.
Well, there's no ways that this is not a long-term process. And I think the challenge is going to be, and it always has been the challenge, and we found it to be the challenge when we went into Iraq, quite frankly. Somebody said that they'd wished they had thought as hard about how you get out of Iraq as how you got into Iraq. Well, the same thing goes for the Israelis. How do you get out of here is the real question, and who do you turn it over to? And for the last year and a half as this war has continued, the Israelis have not really sought that particular alternative that they could present it to. The most likely that most people have talked about is some kind of reformed Palestinian authority that would take control of the Gaza Strip in terms of basic governance. In the interim, perhaps you might consider soliciting support from some of the major Arab nations, think of the Saudis, think of the Emiratis, Kuwaitis perhaps, and others, to provide financial support for the rebuilding phase and perhaps some kind of a pan-Arab peacekeeping force that could provide security in the Gaza Strip, allowing the Israelis to withdraw their forces. But while many people have talked about, it appears there's very little interest on the part of the Netanyahu government as that as a potential alternative.
It seems then that this is still at a place in time that is not stable, fragile, to say the least.
Yeah, without question. Without question. And one has to be concerned to some degree not only about the plight of 2+ million Palestinians. We've had over 57,000 Palestinians killed. Well over 100,000 have been injured. A substantial portion of those have been women and children. From the Israeli perspective, one has to imagine that Israel as well is much more isolated in the international community over the conduct of the conflict. While I think everyone would be enormously sympathetic and supportive of Israel's military response after the attack by Hamas, which killed over 1,250 Israelis and seized several hundred as hostages. Many people have been concerned about this conflict and the aftermath and how it was conducted with this enormous loss of life and depriving the region of basic foodstuffs, water, medical supplies for long periods of time. So that's an isolated problem. And then the other part of the problem, of course, is the United States has provided substantial, we know that, military assistance to Israel in this effort. And I think one thing we need to be concerned about this long term is this radicalized not only people in the Gaza Strip, but across the Middle East as they have watched, you know, this particular war unfold. And could that potentially then cause us future challenges in terms of international terrorism striking back on us because of our support to Israel?
Yeah. Let us pivot real quick, if you don't mind, to Ukraine and Russia. That has been presenting some real difficult challenges. Conversations going on between Trump and Putin. Reassurances being made. Calls, they hang up. Next thing you know, major strategic move and exercise and attack in Ukraine, on the Ukrainians, kind of embarrassing, quite frankly. And I think just yesterday, the day before, the president, for the first time that I can remember, you've been following this more closely than me, I got a touch or a sense that he was embarrassed and that he's maybe had enough. When he specifically said, they're talking bullshit and we need to get to the bottom of this thing. Your thoughts?
Well, I think you're right on both counts. I think on the one count, the president and his administration should be embarrassed when the Pentagon makes an announcement, I think it was on a Thursday, that the United States was going to pause military assistance to Ukraine, ostensibly to review our wartime stockpiles and make sure they hadn't been overly depleted. This was the day prior to the president having a scheduled phone call with Mr. Putin. That would seem to me that in terms of basic negotiating strategy, you don't make a major concession the day before you're going to have that type of conversation.
You know, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Why on any given day would you ever make that statement? Why is it important for anybody to know that statement? Other than your side.
Statement about your pausing the
yeah.
supplies?
Pausing to see what your inventory actually holds.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. You can conduct that kind of inventory in a private fashion, you know, and you don't have to broadcast it. But I think what happens, I think seriously what happened in my sort of read of that, having worked in the Pentagon and worked in the White House both, is that you've had a serious depletion and deterioration of the number of people working on the National Security Council staff, particularly in the aftermath of the so-called Signalgate controversy and by the insistence of people like Lori Loomer, who identified a number of people on the NSC staff that she said were disloyal to Mr. Trump and he subsequently fired. And the NSC is the coordinating agency to make sure all agencies coordinate policy between, you know, the State Department, CIA, Pentagon, et cetera, across the government, so you have coordinated policy. Absent that particular effort, you kind of got what I would call, you know, like watching the film Home Alone, and people in various agencies, in this case the Pentagon, decided that they were going to enact policy that they thought was best for the United States without enacting particular coordination. And if you will, then present a fait accompli. And there are a number of people in the administration who frankly believe any aid to Ukraine is aid that didn't go to our efforts in the Asia-Pacific region, and as a consequence should be halted. And so one way you establish policy is kind of doing an end around and then publicly announcing it as a fait accompli. So that's why I think it was announced. Obviously embarrassing to me, the President of the United States, and pretty much undercutting any kind of conversation that he would have with Mr. Putin. And he came away from that particular conversation, as you quite rightfully point out, saying it was virtually meaningless. But from the standpoint of Mr. Putin, why would you make any concessions about going to a ceasefire if you think your adversary is about to give up anyway?
Yeah. It's almost as if the left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing.
Exactly.
Look, I've never participated in one of these exercises, but I can read the stupid meter pretty well. And the way this whole thing has gone down just reeks of stupid. I mean, I just don't understand. We don't need to share this intelligence with any of these people. It's none of their goddamn business. I mean, I don't understand why you would do it. This is very, very tenuous times. All of these issues may be real. All the more reason you keep it close to the vest. Let them guess what it is. Let them guess how many arms we're going to send if we send arms.
Neil, you're breaking up a little bit on my end. Maybe it's my problem, but As far as this particular effort goes, then now the president has reversed once again and said the United States will provide military assistance to Ukraine. A large portion of this, at least in the immediate future, is Patriot missiles, about 30, which the Ukrainians are very dependent on because that's the only weapon they in the inventory that can intercept, particularly this Dagger ballistic missile, which is a hypersonic missile that the Russians have been using. And as the Russians have intensified their air campaign on cities across the Ukraine, obviously that particular capability becomes more and more important. But it really raises, again, the longer question, you know, and that is, even though the president says he's going to resume it, he's going to provide defensive weapons. And me, as an old soldier, I'm not quite sure what a defensive weapon looks like. It's kind of like beauty. It's in the eyes of the beholder. But it remains to be seen whether or not the United States then is going to actually now move out more smartly in a more unified approach to place pressure on the Russians to see if we can force Mr. Putin to the table, because at the moment, at least, he doesn't seem to have any incentives to do so.
Let me, and this may be a completely stupid question, but I have to ask it. Wouldn't it be better for the Ukrainians to be bombing stuff inside the Russian border?
Well, they are doing that to some degree. I mean, the Ukrainians,
more. I mean, when they say we're sending them defensive weapons, to me, what I'm hearing, I may be all wet, is, you know, we don't really like when they're sending armaments across the territorial line into the country of Russia. And we know why, because now their people are feeling the pain. Their people's lives are disrupted. Their people's are constantly reminded that we're fighting a war. You know, and the defensive weapons are meant to just prevent the Russians shooting over to the Ukrainians that they don't land in inopportune places. Is that wrong? Am I hitting the nail on the head here?
No, I think you are hitting the nail on the head. The worry has always been, since this war began and any military assistance was provided to the Ukraine, you might remember the arguments about do we give them M1 tanks, do we give them HIMARS, do we give them F-16s.
Right.
The concern was, particularly for longer-range weapons, that if they use them on Russian territory, that this may then create escalation. We could see this war widening beyond the borders of Ukraine and therefore engulfing perhaps NATO and the United States. And one of the main objectives for the Biden administration and for the Trump administration, oh, by the way, is to see this particular war was confined to the territory of Ukraine and to some degree the territory of Russia. So there's always been that concern. But hopefully by now, after 6 months, I think Mr. Trump hopefully has now realized that Mr. Putin is not going to move to any type of meaningful negotiations to settle this conflict based on his personal relationships, which he says has always been good with Putin, and number one, and logic, which I think he has applied, which is pretty much American. And that logic is, well, you've suffered 1 million casualties. I'm willing to give you the territory you say you want. Why won't you negotiate? And he doesn't understand. I think the president, or maybe he's finally realized, Mr. Putin doesn't care about 1 million casualties, and he'll go for 2 million. Doesn't matter. And his objectives really exceed the four provinces he claims are his, but are far beyond that. And if not taking over all the Ukraine physically, at least neutralizing the Ukraine and making, if you will, a puppet state of the Russian Federation with further concessions by NATO, et cetera. Those are what he really wants. And that's why he's calling for, let's go to the root cause of the conflict, which he says are those. So as a consequence, you got to raise the level of pain or walk away, one or the other. And the level of pain is, as you suggest, more weapons, perhaps, or more use of weapons by the Ukrainians to conduct attacks, which actually move on the population of the Russian Federation, this dramatic drone attack they did on in the very eastern portion of Russia being illustrative. And second of all, I think the consideration of sanctions. It's been amazing to me that as you and I are talking, over 80 United States senators have agreed on a bilateral proposal to dramatically increase sanctions on the Russian Federation, consistent with what our European allies have said needs to be done as well. And that's been in queue now for several weeks. I mean, my goodness, we can't get 80 senators in the United States Senate to agree on what time it is, but we got them to agree on these sanctions. But they will not bring it to the floor for a vote until the President of the United States says, go ahead, I want to put more pressure on Mr. Putin.
Now, It makes no sense. All, you know, when I read the tea leaves of what happens when the Ukrainians do go on the offensive, do take out some critical infrastructure on the Russian side of the border, that gets the attention of the Russians. You start seeing a little skirmishes talking about the war. This needs to end. You know, just here recently, he's fired three of his higher level individuals. I've been reading that there's more to come. And, you know, every little failure that happens that gets highlighted in the media one way or another doesn't bode well for them. I mean, I would be stringing those media, those failures one after the other to put the pressure on him.
Yeah, I mean, I think unfortunately for Mr. Putin, not that I don't wish him ill, is that he now has put himself in a box. His box was he assumed this was going to be an easy war, be over in a couple of days. Well, now we're heading towards our fourth year. And he has then to show the Russian people something that looks like victory if it's not going to be unsettling. He cannot make a concession, I think, without over time putting himself in a precarious position. And that's the situation. So absent that, he is convinced that his willpower is stronger than the West, and particularly the United States, and so he can continue to pursue this and will eventually give in. At the same time, you're right again that when there are those longer-range attacks, then he looks for a fall guy. I mean, witness the fact that the transportation minister recently turned up apparently committing suicide, and the reason for that, I think, is tied to the fact that he was the governor of the Kursk province, which was invaded by the Ukrainians. That didn't go well. That was embarrassing for the Russians. We got to have a fall guy. It was this guy. So he had been fired and then subsequently committed suicide, ostensibly. But there have been a number of these sort of suicides that have occurred since this war began on the Russian side, which have been curious. My favorite is the guy who the Russians claimed shot himself six times. I mean, if you shoot yourself six times, yeah, boy, you're pretty serious about suicide.
I've never seen any of those, Colonel, in 40 years of law enforcement. Not one of those.
I can send you the a spreadsheet of all those suicides, if you'd like. In several cases, unfortunately, they were the person, the senior Russian involved, killed his family members and then killed himself, you know, which they claimed was what they did in advance. And I would say probably called, you know, shooting the witnesses, you know. But
Well, we will be checking back with you because I think we're in I think you would agree. I think it's very tenuous right now.
To say the least.
You know, and it's going to be interesting to see what comes out here for sure. Thank you so much for joining us. Colonel Jeff McCausland, CBS military analyst, always appreciate your insight and your time. Have a great weekend.
Take care, Neil.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Folks, stay with us.